snow had picked up. It was now coming down in thick clumps, sticking to trees and bushes, but melting on the sidewalks and roads. Before heading to Brian's house in the South End, I went to a wine shop on Charles Street and bought a bottle of Petite Sirah. I was halfway out the store when I turned around. I bought a bottle of Sfak, a Hungarian herbal liqueur that I liked. Then I walked to Old Devil's, where Brandon and Emily would be getting ready to close up for the night. Before entering the store, I stood outside in the snow for a moment, peering through the window into the warm glow of the bookstore's interior. Brandon was talking to a customer, and even though I couldn't hear the specific words, I could hear the deep boom of his voice all the way out on the street. Emily was in the background, moving back and forth behind the checkout desk. Friday nights and Saturdays during the day were the times when the three of us, the Old Devil's bookstore employees, were most likely to all be working, and it felt strange to be outside, looking in. The world kept going, I guess. I pushed through the door and greeted Brandon by offering him the bottle of Zvok. "What?" he said, his voice high, dragging out the word. "Peace offering," I said. "I feel bad I've been so absent lately. You guys have been picking up the slack." "Yeah, we have," he said, and went back to show Emily. I said hello to the customer, a young woman I recognized as a local mystery author who had given a reading at our store the previous year. Her name suddenly escaped me. "How are things?" she said. She had large dark eyes close together in a narrow face. The fact that she parted her straight black hair in the middle made her look like someone Edward Gorey might have drawn. "Things are fine," I said. "What's new with you?" Before she could answer, Brandon had pulled Emily out from the back offices and was calling me over. "You too, Jane," he said. Her full name suddenly came to me. Jane Prendergast. She had written a mystery novel called The Owl Shall Stoop. We walked over to where Brandon was pouring out shots into the small water glasses we kept in the back. "Come in to browse some books and end up getting a shot," I said to Jane. "She's part of the family," Brandon said, and Emily, now holding her drink, flushed a deep red. Brandon looked from her to me and said, "Oh," Emily said, "Jane and I are seeing each other." I said, "That explains why you're always putting Jane's books on the front table." And now Jane looked embarrassed too, and I apologized and said that I was just kidding. The four of us drank. "To Old Devil's," I said. Emily shuddered and asked me what Zvok was. I said I didn't really know, but that it seemed appropriate for the weather, like something a St. Bernard would bring you if you were trapped by an avalanche. I stayed a little longer, but turned down a second drink. It was nearing 7, our closing time, and also the time that I was supposed to be in the South End. I suddenly didn't want to go. It felt safe in the store, and I just didn't know what was going to happen at Brian and Tess's house. I texted Tess and told her I'd be there closer to 7:30, and then I helped Brandon and Emily close up. Jane stuck around, waiting for Emily to get off her shift. By the time I was walking across Boston Common toward the South End, the temperature had dropped some more and snow was beginning to stick to the paved pathways. I passed the Frog Pond, lit up and full of skaters, then walked down Tremont Street, over the Pike and into the South End. Despite the weather, it was a Friday night, and people were out in force, filling the restaurants and bars. The Murrays lived in a bow-fronted brick townhouse on a residential street. Their front door was painted a dark blue. I pushed the doorbell and heard chimed notes from inside.
"Thank you, Mal,"
Tess said as I handed her the bottle of wine, wishing I'd brought them something more interesting.
"Come in, get warm. Brian's upstairs making drinks."
I walked up the narrow stairway, the walls adorned with framed covers from the Ellis Fitzgerald series. At the top of the stairs, I turned and entered the large second-floor living room. Brian was standing and staring into the fireplace, where it looked as though a fire had just been lit. "Hey, Brian," I said. He turned. He was holding a glass of whiskey with his good hand.
"What can I get you?" he said, and I told him I'd have whatever he was having.
From a waist-high cabinet, he poured whiskey from a cut glass decanter into a lowball glass, added a small cube of ice from a bucket, and brought it over to me. On the coffee table between two sofas was a wooden block with cheese and crackers on it. We sat down, and he put down his drink in order to lean over to get himself a cracker.
"How's the arm?" I said. "If you live as long as me, it turns out you just get used to having two arms. It's not so easy to lose one of them, even temporarily."
"Tess helps?"
"Well, yes, she does help, but she won't let me forget that fact. No, I'm kidding. It's nice to have her here. Tell me about the store. What's selling?"
We talked shop for a while. Then Tess came up the stairs and perched on the edge of the sofa that Brian sat on. She wore an apron, and her face was red and shiny, as though she'd been peering into cooking pots. The Murray's dog, a speckled hound called Humphrey, had followed Tess into the room, and after briefly sniffing at my outstretched hand, began nosing toward the cheese board.
"Humphrey!"
Brian and Tess said at the same time, and he sat back on his haunches, his tail slapping the floor.
"What's for dinner?"
I said, and I studied the two of them as she replied. Tess's eyes were bright, as though she was excited. Brian watched her the way he might watch a bartender, with slight disinterest, until, of course, you needed another drink.
"Have one more drink, the two of you, then come downstairs for dinner," Tess said before she left.
She squeezed my shoulder as she passed me on the way to the stairs, then slapped her thigh, and Humphrey followed her out the door.
"I'll get it," I said, and took Brian's empty glass and mine to the liquor cabinet.
I poured two fingers of scotch in his glass and a little less in mine. I added ice to each of our drinks, then brought them back.
"I'll break out the good stuff later," Brian said. "I have a Talisker, 25-year-old, around here somewhere."
"Don't waste it on me," I said. "This tastes fine."
"Well, we're drinking midweek scotch, and unless I'm mistaken, today is Friday. At least that's what Tess said. I'll break out something better later."
"You ever thought of writing a book about drinking?" I said.
"My agent's mentioned it to me a few times. Not because he thinks anyone will buy it, but because he thinks at least I might profit a little from the time I waste drinking the stuff."
"Before I forget," I said, "I just reread The Sticking Place."
"What made you do that?"
he said, but I could tell from his face that he was pleased. "I was going through all my copies of your books, and I just cracked it open and began reading it. Didn't stop until I finished."
"Yeah, I think in retrospect that Ellis should have killed more people. I loved writing that book. You know, I still have readers who send me letters telling me that they pretend that book doesn't exist. And I get letters telling me it's the only good thing I ever wrote."
"Well, can't please everyone all the time."
"That's the truth. I remember when I wrote Sticking Place, I showed it to my agent first. My agent back then, you remember, Bob Drachman? He told me he couldn't put it down, but that they'd never publish it. Ellis wasn't a cold-hearted killer, he said. You'll lose half your readers. I told him I might lose half, but I'd get twice as many back. He asked for a second draft, one that wasn't so brutal, so of course I added another murder."
"Which one?" I said.
"Ah, I can't remember. Oh no, I do. I think it's the guy she locks in the freezer and leaves there. Yeah, that was the one, because Bob admitted he liked that scene when he read the final book. Anyway, I told him to submit the manuscript or I'd look for another agent, and so he sent it in. They published it, and guess what? The world kept turning."
"And you probably doubled your readers."
"I don't know about that, but I didn't lose many. And I picked up an Edgar, so there was that."
"It's a good book."
"Thanks for that, Mal," he said.
"You never wanted to write another one in the same vein? Another Ellis revenge book?"
"Nah, not really. Thing is, you only need to do it once, and then the reader knows that Ellis has this side to her.
but if every time she lost someone she loved, she went on some kind of killing spree, then she'd be someone else. No, it only happens once. She gets broken. She gets her revenge, and she knows she can never let that side of her take over again. I did, however, write a book without her once. Did I ever tell you about that? He had, of course, but I told him that I didn't think so. Yeah, I wrote a standalone. This was a couple of years after Sticking Place, I think. It was another revenge book, but with a guy this time. South Boston cop whose wife gets raped and murdered by a bunch of Irish thugs. He tracks them down and takes them all out. I wrote it in about 2 weeks, read it over, and realized I'd basically rewritten Sticking Place. So I stuck it in my drawer and forgot about it.
You still have it?
Jesus, he said, scratching the side of his rubbery nose. That's when I was living with Mary out in Newton, so who knows if it survived the move. But yeah, I don't remember throwing it out, so it's around here somewhere.
You talking about Mary? Tess said, coming into the room. She was no longer wearing the apron, and it looked as though she'd put on some makeup.
Yeah, the good old days, Brian said. Dinner ready?
Dinner's ready.
We went down to the ground floor and ate by candlelight at the dining room table nestled in front of the bay window that looked out onto the street. Humphrey the dog had been given some sort of treat and was busy chewing on it from his dog bed in the corner. Tess had made braised short ribs, and between the three of us, we went through 3 bottles of wine before she brought out dessert, a clementine tart.
Did you make this? I said.
God, no. I cook, but I don't bake. Who wants port?
We don't, Brian said, looking at me. Let's have some of that whiskey I was talking about earlier, the Talisker.
You can have that, Tess said. I'll have port.
Can I get it for you? I said, and stood up, banging my thigh a little against the edge of the table.
Thank you, Mal. That would be lovely. There's port down in our cellar. Bri, tell him which bottle he should grab. And the whiskey's upstairs, I think.
I was given my instructions and went down into the basement first to look for the port. I'd never been down there before. It was semi-finished, the walls sheetrocked, but the floor just poured cement. Along one wall was an enormous bookcase. I went over to look at it and found that it was entirely filled with books by Brian Murray, all the various versions, including foreign editions of his Ellis Fitzgerald series. I stood, staring at them for a moment, aware that I'd had far too much to drink at dinner. The dim light of the basement made it feel like I was in a dream. Conversation at dinner had been entertaining. Tess and Brian using me as an audience for their slightly hostile, slightly flirty back-and-forth insults. But as I swayed in front of the bookshelf, holding what looked to be a Russian paperback edition of To Play the Villain, I kept thinking back to what Brian and I had talked about over drinks, about how much he clearly enjoyed writing his violent revenge novels, how he'd written a second one and never published it. I wanted to get back to that conversation. The other side of the basement was filled with floor-to-ceiling wine racks. Brian had told me to look for a bottle of Taylor Fladgate Tawny Port that should be in the upper right. I pulled several bottles out before I found the right one and brought it back upstairs and into the kitchen where Tess was piling dishes in their enormous sink. For you, I said. I was not entirely surprised when, after she took the bottle, she thanked me, then placed it on the counter and pulled me in for a hug.
So nice to have you here, Mal, she said. I hope you're having fun, too.
Of course, I said.
She placed a hand along my jawline and told me how sweet I was.
Go get Brian his whiskey before he sobers up. I'll open the port.
I went up the stairs and into the living room. All that remained of the fire was a few smoldering embers and a pile of ash. The room was still warm. I walked to the liquor cabinet, crouched down, and opened it. Inside there were about 12 bottles, all whiskey as far as I could tell. I found the Talisker and pulled it out.
Behind it was a triangular bottle of whiskey called Dimple Pinch. It was the same scotch that had been lying at the feet of Nick Pruitt. I was sure of it. The shape of the bottle was so unique, three-sided and each side dented in a little. Thin wire encased the bottle. I dug further into the cabinet and found there were two more bottles of the same scotch, each unopened. This was probably Brian's midweek scotch, the one he put in his decanter on top of the cabinet. I stood, still holding the Talisker, wishing I was less drunk, wishing I could figure out exactly what to do next. I heard someone enter the room, but it was only Humphrey, breathing heavily, bounding toward the cheese and crackers still on the coffee table. Chapter 25. With the whiskey between us, I listened to Brian tell the story of the weekend he spent getting drunk with Charles Williford in Miami. Brian knew I was a fan of the burnt orange heresy, so he'd told me the Williford story many times. It changed a little bit every time. I'm not a connoisseur of scotch, but even I could tell that the Talisker was good stuff. Still, I'd bring the glass to my lips and only sip the tiniest amount. I needed to think about the significance of those bottles of Dimple Pinch I'd seen in the cabinet upstairs. Could Brian Murray be Charlie? My immediate answer was a definitive no. He was one of those men who could talk a good game, but who couldn't actually do a whole lot of things. He didn't drive. He couldn't cook. I'm sure he didn't make his own travel arrangements or file his own taxes or figure out his own bills. He could write. He could drink, and he could talk. There'd be no way for him to plan, then execute actual murders. But what if he had help? While we drank, I could see through into the kitchen where Tess was cleaning up, humming to herself. She seemed happy, relaxed, almost. There was a break in Brian's story, and I said, "Did you ever read the blog posts that I wrote for the website?"
What website?
He said. Our website, the old devil's site, the blog that's attached to it.
Oh, right,
he said, remembering. I'd pestered him over the years to write something for it, just an occasional book recommendation or a list of his favorites, but he never did.
Oh, what about it?
Do you remember a list I wrote a few years back, even before you were an owner, called 8 Perfect Murders? He scratched at the inside of his eye, and I studied him.
That list, I do remember, he finally said. I think the first time I ever knew your name was from reading that list. And you know what I thought?
No.
I thought, I can't believe the prick didn't include one of my books.
I laughed. Is that really what you thought?
Sure. You get to a point in your career where every 10 best list or year-end best list is a personal affront if you're not part of it. But the thing was, if I remember correctly, it wasn't that you didn't include one of my books, it's that you hadn't included The Reaping Season. I mean, Jesus, Mal, come on.
He was smiling now.
Help me out, I said. The one with Carl...
With Carl Boyd,
right.
I did remember that one. It was an early book. The villain Carl Boyd was a psychopath out to get revenge on everyone who had ever belittled him. And that included a lot of people. If I remembered it correctly, Carl was a pharmacist. He'd kidnap his victims before killing them, give them an injection of sodium pentothal or something similar, something to make them tell the truth. Then he'd ask them what their worst fear was, ask them to describe the death that terrified them most. Someone would admit that he was claustrophobic, for example, so Carl Boyd would bury him alive in a box.
How could I forget that one? I said. Apparently you did.
It wouldn't have fit in on that list I was doing anyway. That was specifically for perfect murders, unsolvable murders.
What are you two talking about?
It was Tess coming in from the kitchen, wiping her damp hands down her thighs.
Murder, I said, at the same time that Brian said,
disrespect.
Good times, Tess said. I was thinking of brewing a pot of coffee and wanted to know how much I should make. Brian, yes, I know you're not interested.
I'll have some, I said.
Regular? Decaf?
I'll have the real stuff, I said, and wondered if I'd slurred a little on the word stuff. She turned back to the kitchen, and Brian said,
there's no such thing, really.
No such thing as what? I said.
I'm talking about the list you wrote, he said. There's no such thing as a perfect murder.
In fiction or in real life?
In both. Too many variables, always. Let me guess what you had on that list. Strangers on a train, right?
Right, I said. Brian was sitting up a little taller now, seemed a little less drunk.
Ah, of course you did. I actually remember this list now, and not just because I wasn't on it. Strangers on a train, no disrespect to Pat Highsmith, is a stupid idea for a perfect murder. What makes it clever? That you get some stranger to do your killing for you? And that way you can have a rock-solid alibi? Not a chance. The minute you get some stranger to kill someone for you, you might as well turn yourself into the police. It's too unpredictable. If you're going to kill someone, kill them yourself. You can't trust someone else with a killing.
What if you knew for a fact that the person would never turn you in? Brian made a face, lowering his brow and tightening his mouth.
Look, he said. I don't pretend to be an expert in psychology, but I do know one thing, and it's the one thing I remind myself over and over when I write a book. No one knows what's going on in another person's mind or in their heart.
He touched his head and his chest.
They just don't. Not even a married couple that have been together for 50 years. You think they know what each other's thinking? They don't. None of us know shit.
So you don't know what Tess is thinking right now?
Well, he said, and raised his eyebrows, shrugging. I know some of what she's thinking about tonight, but that's only because she told me.
That doesn't count.
No, it doesn't. All right, then, what is she thinking, besides trying to remember how many scoops of coffee it takes to make a pot? I don't really know. Well, that's not entirely true. I know a bunch of what she's thinking. For example, she's probably counting my drinks and wondering at what point she'll decide to tell me I've had enough. She's probably already thinking about some pair of $300 jeans she wants to buy. And she's thinking about you, buddy.
Well, what do you mean?
Ever since we ran into you at the bar the other night, she's been talking nonstop about getting you over here for dinner.
She's got an agenda, I said, remembering what she told me about wanting me to convince Brian to get some help into the house.
Tess always has an agenda.
I could smell the coffee now from the kitchen, a dark, bitter smell that made me feel more sober just by smelling it. The shift in conversation to Tess had unnerved me. I'd known Brian a long time, and I'd seen him drunk many, many times. But the way he was acting now, like he had a secret, was something new to me. He'd always been someone who told me what was on his mind.
What's her agenda tonight? I said.
I have an idea, but like I said earlier, we never really know what's going on inside of someone's head.
I heard the clink of porcelain on porcelain and turned to see Tess coming toward the table, carrying a tray that contained 2 coffee cups plus sugar and cream. She placed one of the cups and its saucer in front of me, then sat down, sighing as she did so.
Thank you, I said, adding some cream to my coffee and taking a sip. You want some Irish whiskey for that coffee? Brian said. I've got some around here, somewhere. Just don't put scotch in it.
It's perfect as is, I said.
Really? Tess said. What have you two been talking about out here?
She was adding cream and stirring her coffee. Her lips were slightly stained from the port she'd been drinking, and her hair, which normally hung down on either side of her face, was pushed back behind her ears.
You tell her, Brian said. I have to go take a leak.
He put his good hand on the table and stood up. Tess and I both watched him, waiting to see how steady he'd be, but he seemed okay as he walked from the room.
"Did you mention anything about him getting some real help in here?" Tess said after we both heard the bathroom door shut.
"Ah, I didn't know," I said. "I forgot we talked about that."
"That's okay," she said. "Anything you mention to him tonight, he's not going to remember in the morning anyway. I am curious, though, what you two were blathering on about in here. Brian sounded almost passionate."
"He was talking about how no one really knows anyone else, how we never know exactly what another person is thinking about."
"You think that's true?"
she said, blowing on her coffee. She had little lines around her lips, as though she'd once been a smoker. I had a vague image of seeing her smoke a cigarette, but not for years. "I do, actually. I think about it a lot, how we never know the truth of people. But I don't always know if that's just me or if it's everyone."
"If what's just you?"
she said. "I think I have a hard time getting to know people. Not superficially, I'm fine with that. But when I get close to someone, that's when I feel they disappear. That's when I look at them and I suddenly have no idea what they're really like or what they're really thinking."
"Was that how you felt about your wife?"
she said. "Claire?" I said automatically. Tess laughed.
"Unless you've been married more than I know about."
I thought for a moment, trying to remember if I'd ever discussed Claire with Tess in the past, or even if I'd ever discussed Claire with Brian. "What was the question?" I finally said.
"Ugh, I've made you uncomfortable. I'm sorry."
No, I'm just a little drunk."
"Drink your coffee. It'll help."
I took another sip. Then, without really thinking about it, I let the coffee slide back out of my mouth into the cup. I was being paranoid, I knew, but if Tess or Brian or both of them had intentions to harm me, putting drugs in my food or drink would make a lot of sense. "I felt closer to Claire than I've ever felt to anyone before or since," I said. "But sometimes I didn't know her." Tess was nodding.
"I feel the same way about Brian. Close, I mean. Then every once in a while he'll say something, or else I'll read something he wrote, and I wonder if I know anything about him at all. It's universal, that feeling." "What got you two talking about that?"
I thought back, worried that my brain was working too slowly. "We were talking about a list I wrote once, about perfect murders. And Brian was saying how you could never trust anyone to commit a murder for you, that you never really knew what they were thinking." Tess was quiet for a moment, thinking.
"I guess if you were going to get someone to commit a murder for you, the best person would be your spouse."
"Yeah," I said. "Would you do that for Brian?"
"I suppose it would depend on who he wanted me to murder. But I'd think about it. It's just the kind of wife I am. People think that Brian broke up with Mary and married me because I was younger, but that wasn't it at all. Even though we spend a lot of time apart, Brian and I, we're very close, you know, closer than he ever was with anyone. We're loyal. I'd do anything for him, and he'd do anything for me."
She leaned in toward me as she was talking, and I could smell the coffee on her breath mixed with the wine. "Speaking of Brian," I said, and she leaned back, cocked her head to listen.
"He's fine, I think," she said. "He's probably just giving you and me some time alone together."
"Are you sure? Maybe we should check on him." I was suddenly nervous. Maybe it was all the alcohol, but I felt like I was in a stage play and that the evening had been planned in such a way as to culminate with me alone with Tess over coffee. She touched my knee with her fingers, then stood.
"You're right. I'll go get him and tell him it's time to go to bed. But you should stay, Mal. I mean it. The night is young. Let's move over there and have another drink."
She tilted her head to indicate two small couches facing each other by a tall bookcase, forming a cozy nook between the dining room and the open kitchen. "Okay," I said, and she got up and walked out of the room. I sat for a moment, trying to figure out what to do. There was music playing from the kitchen, Ella Fitzgerald singing Moonlight in Vermont. I sniffed at my undrunk coffee, then took another small sip. Then I picked up Tess's coffee and tried that. Like mine, she'd only put cream in it, no sugar, but it tasted noticeably different. I went back and forth between the two, wondering if I was going insane. If she'd wanted to poison me, she could have put something in my wine or even in the food. Still, maybe she'd wanted to wait until the end of the meal. I stood up, walking past the couches and into the kitchen. I could now hear Tess's voice speaking to Brian down the hall, but couldn't make out the words. The kitchen was immaculate. I didn't know exactly what I was looking for, just something that would further prove what I was already suspecting, that I'd been brought here for a reason. I went and looked at the deep stainless steel sink. It was empty. In the dish rack were a few pots and pans, and I could hear the steady thrum of a dishwasher, although I couldn't see where one was. Beside the coffee pot, its red light on, was a cutting board, and on top of the cutting board was a cylindrical piece of wood, very heavy. I picked it up, and it felt like a weapon in my hand. It was probably a rolling pin, although different from any rolling pin I'd ever seen.
"What you looking for, Mal?"
Tess stood at the entrance to the kitchen. "Oh, nothing," I said. "Just admiring your kitchen. How's Brian?"
"Asleep in the downstairs guest room, or as I like to call it, Brian's bedroom. He's in there more nights than he's upstairs."
I put the rolling pin down on the cutting board. "I'm going to get going," I said.
"You sure?"
"Yes, I'm a little drunk myself, I think, and I haven't been sleeping well lately. I'm just going to head home."
"I understand," Tess said. "I don't like it, but I understand. Let me get your coat."
I stood in the foyer and waited for what seemed like a long time. Then Tess brought me my winter coat, tucked under an arm. She came up close to me and said,
"What if I told you you weren't allowed to leave?"
Her voice was different. Flatter, quieter. I grabbed my coat with my left hand and shoved out with my right, hoping to put her off balance long enough for me to get out the door. She stumbled backward, then fell, landing in a sitting position on the hardwood floor.
"Ow! What the fuck, Mal?"
she said. "Stay right there." I shook the coat, now in my possession, wondering if she'd hidden a weapon in it. The rolling pin, maybe? Tess rolled a little onto her side in order to get her legs under her.
"What is up with you?" she said.
Doubt flooded me, but I said, "I know what you did to Nick Pruitt," just hoping that saying a name out loud would help confirm it. She looked up at me, her hair now hanging on either side of her face, and said,
"I have no idea who you're talking about. Who's Nick Pruitt?"
"You killed him 2 nights ago. You saw his book in my store, and you realized that I was investigating him because of his relationship with Norman Chaney. So you got to him first. You got him to drink with you. Dimple pinch whiskey. Maybe you goaded him into drinking too much." Tess was staring at me, her eyes confused and her mouth in a half smile, as though at any moment I was going to reveal the punchline to a joke. "Don't you want me to know about it? To know about you? Isn't that why I'm here?" Tess now looked concerned. She said,
"Mal, I'm going to get up. I have no idea what you're talking about. Is this something between you and Brian? Is this a joke?"
"You know that list I mentioned," I said.
"The list of murders?"
"Someone is using that list to actually kill people. I know I sound crazy. I'm not. The FBI have been talking with me. I thought it might have something to do with you, or with Brian."
"Why?"
she said. "Why were our coffees different? Why did you just tell me I couldn't leave?" She lowered her head and laughed a little.
"Please, help me up. I promise I won't kill you."
I leaned down and she took my hand and I helped her to her feet.
"Our coffees tasted different, because mine is decaf and yours was regular. And the reason I said you couldn't leave was because I was trying to seduce you.
Oh, I said.
Brian knew, or Brian knows, I mean, that I was going to try. He's fine with it. That part of our life is over, and now that I'm here in Boston for a while, he likes you,
she shrugged.
So did I.
Sorry, I said.
Don't be sorry. It's just ridiculous, is all. I'm trying to get you to spend the night and you think I'm trying to kill you.
I haven't been getting much sleep, I said, suddenly embarrassed.
Is it true about the list?
It is, I said. Someone's using it to kill people, and I'm pretty sure it's someone who knows me.
Jesus. Are you willing to tell me about it? It really isn't that late.
Not right now, okay? I said. I really do think I should get going. I'm sorry I pushed you. I'm sorry.
It's fine,
she said, and hugged me, squeezing tight. I thought she'd try and kiss me as well, but I guess that moment had passed. She pulled away and said,
Have a safe walk home. You want me to call you a cab or anything?
No, thanks, I said. And next time we see each other, I'll tell you more about what's been going on.
I'll hold you to that.
After the door shut behind me, I stood outside on their front stoop for a moment. The street was quiet, the snow sticking to everything. I heard the distant sound of music and saw that people were exiting a bar down on the corner. I took the 3 steps down to the sidewalk and turned left, aware that I was stepping on pristine snow, leaving behind fresh marks. I hadn't gone even half a block when I heard the steps behind me, rushing, and I turned to see Tess moving fast, coatless, something in her hand. I must have flinched because she stopped 3 feet away from me and reached out with a book in her hand.
I forgot, she said, a little bit breathless. Brian really wanted you to have this. It's an ARC of his new one. Don't tell him I told you, but he's going to dedicate it to you.
Chapter 26. I was home an hour later, cold and damp and out of breath from clambering up my steep street in the accumulating snow. I shed my coat and my shoes and socks and lay down on the sofa in the dark. I needed to think. If nothing else, the long walk home had sobered me up, and images from the farcical night I'd just spent at Brian and Tess's kept repeating in my mind. It now seemed ridiculous that I had accused Tess of murdering Nick Pruitt and the others from the list, but when I'd said it, when I'd been there, convinced my coffee had been poisoned, it made perfect sense. I wondered what Tess was doing right now. Had she woken Brian up, told him the story of how I'd shoved her to the ground and accused her of murder? Did she think I'd gone insane? I decided that I'd call her first thing in the morning, maybe confide in her a little more about what had been going on recently. I also thought a little bit about her offer, about the reason I was brought to their house in the first place. In different circumstances, I might be in bed with Tess Murray right now. I sat up, and Brian Murray's book fell off my lap and onto the floor. I turned on the lamp, then picked the book up, looking at it for the first time. The title was The Wild Air, and the cover art, like the art of so many of his covers, showed the back of Ellis Fitzgerald looking out toward some sort of landscape or crime scene. On this cover, she was looking at a single tree on the horizon line, a flock of birds taking off from its branches, one of the birds lying on a snow-covered field, presumably dead. I turned to the page where the dedication usually was, and all it said was Dedication TK, editor speak for text that wasn't available yet. I wondered if Brian would still dedicate the book to me after he found out I thought his wife was a murderer. The book began with a line of dialogue. What do you have? Mitch asked. Ellis hesitated. Her answer was, a glass of wine. It was always a glass of wine. But this time she said, soda water and cranberry, thanks. I thought about reading the rest, but I decided I needed to get some rest instead. I put the book on the coffee table, turned off the lamp, and turned onto my side on the sofa, closing my eyes. I lasted about 5 minutes. My mind kept revving, going over and over the events of the past few days. Then I remembered the message I'd left on Duckburg, trying to reconnect with Charlie, and wondered if I had a response. I went and got my laptop, bringing it back to the sofa, and logged on under Farley Walker, my new alias. A blue dot indicated that I'd received a response to my latest message. I clicked through and read it. "Hello, old friend," was all it said. I wrote back, "Are you who I think you are?" There was no timestamp on the message, so I didn't know when I'd gotten it. Still, I waited, staring at the screen. Just when I was about to give up, a new message popped up. "Do you even know my name, Malcolm?" I wrote back. "I don't. Why don't you tell me?" "Maybe I will, but we should go to a private chat first." I checked the box that made the conversation private. My heart was beating, and my jaw was clenched so tight that it was starting to throb. "Why?" I wrote. "Why what? Why did I keep going with something that you started? I think a better question is, why did you stop?" "I stopped because there was only one person that I wanted dead, and once he was dead, there was no reason to go on killing." There was a lengthy pause, and I was suddenly nervous that Charlie had logged off. I wanted to talk with him more. Also, this was ridiculous, but it felt safe somehow, seeing the words he was typing on the screen. It meant he wasn't doing anything else, I suppose. "Sorry for the delay," he eventually wrote. "I need to be quiet where I am." "Where are you?" "I'll tell you, but not right now. It will ruin the rest of this conversation, and I'm really happy to be having this conversation." Something about his tone was starting to get to me, and I wrote, "You are fucking insane, you know that?" A short pause. Then, "I thought I was too. After I killed Eric Atwell for you, I felt so incredible good that I was convinced that I was a monster. It was all I could think about. I shot him 5 times, and it was the 5th shot that killed him. The 1st shot went into his stomach. He was in a lot of pain, but after I told him why he was going to die, I saw all that pain get replaced by fear. I saw the knowledge on his face, the knowledge that he was about to die. Did you see that with Chaney?" "No," I wrote back. "Did he know why he was dying?" "I don't know. I didn't tell him." "Maybe that's why you didn't enjoy it like I did. Maybe if you'd seen it in his eyes, him knowing what was happening to him and why, then you'd understand." "I didn't get any pleasure out of it," I wrote, "and you did. That's a big difference between us." "That's why I think you're the insane one," he wrote. "You write a list that celebrates the art of murder, and then I decide to actually do what that list proposes, to create actual art, and that doesn't make sense to you?" "There's a difference between fiction and reality." "Not as much as you'd think," Charlie wrote. "There's beauty in both, and I know that you know that." I wrote out the words, "There wasn't any beauty when I killed Norman Chaney," then deleted them. I needed to think for a moment. I needed to get Charlie to trust me, to tell me either who he was or where he was. I wrote, "Can we meet?" "Oh, we've met," came immediately back. "When?" "I can see where you're going with this. Just to save time, I am not going to tell you who I am. Not now, like this. There's more work to be done. It's amazing how you keep leading me to new, perfect victims. You handed me Nick Pruitt on a silver platter." "He wasn't guilty of anything." "He was guilty of something, believe me. I thought it would be harder to get him to drink himself to death,
but I think he almost enjoyed it. The first drink was the hardest. Then he just kept drinking whatever I gave him. He seemed almost happy.
I don't suppose I can get you to turn yourself in before you do anything else.
Only if you go with me, he wrote, like I hoped he would.
Of course, I wrote back. You and I together will tell the whole truth. There was a long pause, and I thought I'd lost him. Or else I thought he was actually thinking about it. Finally, he wrote,
It's tempting, but I'm not done yet. And the thing is that you've provided me with two more victims, one who will die and one who will go missing, just like Red House Mystery. You can help if you like. My body went cold.
Let me think about it, I wrote back, already standing. I dressed quickly, pulling my damp socks back on and putting on my shoes. I was shaking. He would be on his way right now to Brian and Tess's house, or else he was already there. I grabbed my cell phone and immediately called Tess's number, thinking I could warn her not to let anyone into the house. It went straight to voicemail, and I didn't leave a message. I thought of calling 911, but somehow I knew that if I did make that call, the police would show up to find nothing, and I'd be stuck explaining why I'd made the call in the first place. I told myself I was making the right decision. Outside, it was snowing harder than it had been all night. I went up the hill to where my car was parked. The roads would be terrible, but I still thought I could get to the South End faster by car than on foot. I U-turned and drove too fast down the hill, the car sliding at the bottom when I applied the brake, turning almost sideways. I took my foot off the brake and started tapping it, but the car kept going, sliding on its own accord through a red light and onto Charles Street. I braced for an impact, but there were no other drivers on the street. And just a few pedestrians, including a couple that had stopped on the sidewalk to watch my near accident. When the car finally stopped, it was angled diagonally but pointing more or less in the right direction. I straightened it out and kept driving, going slower this time, telling myself that spinning off the road was the worst thing that could happen. Unless he was just trying to scare me, Charlie had identified his next victims. If I could get there first, I could at least warn them. But I was also wondering if Charlie was already there. He might have been in their house when we were having the conversation on Duckburg, writing from his phone. It would explain the typing errors. I tried to concentrate on steering and not think about it. The snow was driving now, directly into my windshield. My wipers were working, but ice was building up along the edges, and the windshield was fogging. I turned the defrost all the way up, rolled down my window, and stuck my head out, driving along the edge of the common on Arlington that way. Then I got onto Tremont, and my windshield had cleared a little. I knew that I couldn't turn onto the Murray's one-way street, so I'd already planned on leaving the car at the corner and walking the rest of the way. But then I passed their street and decided to keep going, to take my next right and see if I could loop back. My body ached, and I forced myself to loosen my grip on the steering wheel. The side street I was on hadn't been plowed recently, and my wheels were spinning as I whipped along. As soon as I could, I turned right, then right again, hoping that would put me on the Murray's side street. It looked right, even though all the residential streets in the South End looked alike to me. I slowed down, peering out my window to see if I could pick out the Murray's house with its blue door. I was about 3/4 down the street when I spotted it. Unlike most of the brick townhouses, light glowed still from its street-facing windows. I tried not to think what that might mean, what I might find when I entered the house. I parked in front of a hydrant, killed the engine, and stepped out of the car into 3 inches of icy slush. As I crossed the street toward the Murray's house, I heard someone shout out, "Can't park there!" and turned to see a woman standing under a streetlight with her dog about 4 houses down. I waved at her and kept going. I reached the door and suddenly wished that I had some kind of weapon, anything, really, and almost considered going back to my car to get the tire jack from the trunk. But I didn't want to waste any more time. I tried the door and it was locked,
Then I pressed the doorbell while knocking at the same time, wondering what I'd do if no one answered. I was wiping at the octagonal window in the middle of the door when I heard footsteps on the other side. The door swung open. Chapter 27.
Mal,
Tess said in a husky voice, reaching out and taking hold of the inside of my jacket, pulling me inside.
Is everything okay here?
I said, but she was shutting the door. And then she pushed herself up against me, and we were kissing. I kissed back, part of it relief that she was still here, still alive, and part because it just felt good. I also didn't want to tell her right away that I'd come back because I thought she was in danger. It would sound ludicrous. We stopped kissing and hugged. She felt heavy in my arms, and I asked her again, "Everything okay here?" She stepped out of our embrace, backed up, and said,
"Why do you keep saying that?"
Her voice was thick, and she blinked rapidly.
"You just seem... Are you drunk?"
I said.
"Maybe,"
she said.
"So what? You're drunk."
She turned away from me, and her whole body lurched, as though she were about to fall. I moved quickly and took her by the arm, led her to one of the two facing couches just outside of the entryway to the kitchen. We both sat.
"I feel strange,"
she said, putting a hand on my shoulder and leaning in. Her breath was bitter with the smell of coffee. "Tell me what you've been doing since I left," I said.
"When did you leave?"
2 hours ago, maybe less. I'm not sure exactly.
"Oh, right. I licked my wounds because, you know, and had some more coffee, and then I got tired, real tired, and I was going to go upstairs and get ready for bed, but thought I might take a little nap here on this couch, and then I heard the door and you were here."
"Anyone else come by?"
"Anyone else come by? Here?" "No, just you. Do you want to kiss again?"
I leaned in and kissed her, hoping to keep it short, but she opened her mouth and pressed hard against me. My eyes were open, but her hair was falling in waves, and for a moment I couldn't see anything. I stopped the kiss and brought her head down to my chest.
"That's nice,"
she said, then mumbled something I couldn't understand. We were like that for a minute. I could tell she was falling asleep on me, and I let it happen while I looked around at what I could see. It looked just as it had when I left, our coffee cup still on the dining room table in front of the bay window, a single lamp still on by the table. And what I could see of the kitchen was lit by the under-cabinet lighting. The house was quiet, although I thought I could hear Brian snoring in the downstairs guest room. I wasn't sure. But if it was him, it was a good sign. He was still alive. I knew that Charlie was in the house. I'd already constructed a scenario. He'd followed me here tonight, probably waiting outside while I was inside having dinner with Brian and Tess. When I'd left, maybe he'd been planning to follow me, or maybe he'd been planning on breaking into Tess and Brian's house. But then an opportunity had presented itself. Tess had rushed out to give me Brian's book, leaving the door open behind her and unlocked. Charlie snuck inside. And then what? He'd hidden in the house, and somehow he had managed to put something in Tess's coffee, probably whatever it was that he'd spiked Pruitt's whiskey with. I didn't believe she was drunk, or that she was any more drunk than she'd been when I'd left 2 hours earlier. No, she'd been drugged. And then I'd arrived before Charlie had done anything else to her. And now here we all were in the house together. Where was Charlie, exactly? Where would I be if I were him? I slowly eased Tess off my chest and onto the couch, then stood up.
"Where are you going?"
Tess said, but her voice was low and mumbled. She tucked a hand under her cheek and breathed deeply in through her nose, her eyes still closed. I walked as quietly as I could into the kitchen. A side door led to the first floor hallway.
From there, you could get to a half bathroom and to the guest room where Brian was sleeping. There was also a closet, if I remembered correctly. I went to the counter and found the rolling pin I'd noticed earlier, picking it up in my right hand. I thought of getting a knife instead, but I liked how the rolling pin felt. It was a heavy piece of wood, obviously useless if Charlie had a gun. But it was something, and I felt better with it in my hand. I considered staying in the kitchen, just standing there with my view on both the swinging side door and the large cutout that led to the dining and living room area. I could stand here all night, waiting for Charlie to make a move first. But I was also worried about Tess. Whatever was in her system might be enough to kill her. In what I hoped was my normal voice, I said, "I know you're here," out loud to the empty kitchen. Nothing. I waited for what felt like another 5 minutes and began to wonder if I was just being paranoid. Maybe Tess had just kept drinking after I'd left and she was simply drunk. And maybe Charlie had been playing with me at this point, trying to manipulate me into rushing over here for nothing. I walked slowly back through into the living area. Tess hadn't moved. She was still curled up on the couch, a hand under her face. I crouched down and could hear her steady breathing. I turned left toward the hallway, aware that the old floor was creaking under every step. After I walked past the stairway, I pushed open the door to the bathroom. There was enough light from a lamp in the hallway for me to see that it was empty. Then I heard the sound of steps behind me, and I froze. The steps stopped coming, but I could hear heavy breathing. I turned, tightening my grip on the rolling pin. Humphrey, the hound dog, stood looking at me quizzically. I put my free hand out and he came forward sniffing at it, then losing interest and turning back toward the living room. I turned again, deciding that I needed to look in on Brian, asleep in the guest room, and to make sure he was alone. Then maybe I could just leave the house. Maybe I didn't need to be here.
"What's the dog's name?"
The voice came from behind me. I recognized it, of course, and turned to see him, standing at the bottom of the stairs, the foyer light behind him so that his face was in shadow. He held a gun at his side, casually, but when I took a step toward him, toward Marty Kingship, he lifted it and pointed it at my chest. Chapter 28. "Humphrey," I said.
"Huh,"
he said.
"Like the actor?"
"I guess so. I don't know."
"Some guard dog."
"Yeah," I said. There was something in Marty's other hand, and it took me a moment to realize it was a cell phone. It looked out of place on Marty. I'd had drinks with him many times, seen him at readings at my store, but somehow I couldn't recall ever seeing him look at a cell phone. I'd never seen him with a gun, either, but the cell phone looked more foreign on him than the gun.
"How long have you been here?"
I said. "Were you typing on that thing? On the Duckburg site?" I jerked my head to indicate the phone.
"Yeah," he said. "Not bad, right? With my sausage fingers. Hey, look, let's go sit down."
He gestured with the gun.
"Maybe around the table. You can put down whatever it is you're holding in your hand, and I won't have to point this at you. Then we can have a nice chat."
"Okay," I said. He turned and walked toward the table. I pictured myself sprinting and lunging, hitting him just as he turned with the gun, knocking him down on the ground. But all I did was follow him, and together we both sat at the table in the same seats that Tess and I had been sitting in a few hours earlier. Marty pushed his back a few feet, then rested the gun on his thigh.
"What is that you're holding?"
"It's a rolling pin," I said, setting it down on the table.
"You pick it up here or bring it with you?"
"No, I picked it up here." There was a hanging ceiling light above the table that was still on, and I could see Marty's face much better in its light. He looked the way he always looked, sallow skin, disheveled, and like he'd forgotten to get any sleep lately, but there was something a little different about his eyes.
I want to say they were more intense, more alive, but that wasn't quite it. It was more that they were happy. He might not be smiling, but his eyes were.
"Thought you might come here with more firepower," he said. "Although I realize that's probably not your thing. Did you call the police?"
"Yes," I quickly said. "They'll be on their way right now." He frowned.
"Let's not lie to each other. Let's tell the truth, and then, together, we can figure out where to go next. I know you're thinking that your only chance here is to get the jump on me, but it's not. I'm going to be reasonable. And honestly, I'm not young, but what is that word they condescendingly use for old people when they can get around on their own 2 feet?
Spry, I said.